So, the last talk of session three this afternoon is by another person who is no stranger to the Water Center's reviews. Derek Booth will talk to us on differences in West Coast watersheds and the streams they create. Derek?
Thank you very much. You know, one of the things that I've noticed over the last few years is that since the time that I ceased to be the director of the Water Center and Ann took over, the attendance at these events has gotten larger and larger and larger. It's really great. So welcome all. Thanks to those who have put this on. As many of you know, I've started wandering a little bit farther afield since leaving active directorship of the Water Center. Not quite as far as Bob. I seem to like to keep a hand still on the Pacific Ocean, or at least in shouting distance of it. And I'd like to share with you a few of the, observations and information that come of a somewhat broader, more regional perspective. So, my points today. This is certainly preaching to the converted, but sometimes it's nice to see some tangible examples of it, I hope. Streams are different because their watersheds are different, and it's well worth understanding those differences. Secondly, making predictions or understandings or taking management actions require that you understand those differences. Anybody who practices stream classification, anybody who subscribes to alphabets, are doing this already. It's not necessarily bad, but you definitely need to know what you're up to and understand where there may be shortcomings. And lastly, information that is not only useful but is used really requires that you understand these attributes. So I'm going to take you on a little tour, if you will, of a few different streams and their watersheds in a attempt in the course of the next 15 or 20 minutes to illustrate what I mean. So as I say, always within shouting distance of the Pacific Ocean, one that's very long-standing stomping ground for me and actually many others of you in this room, Issaquah Creek, and then something down in Southern California and up in Alaska. So we'll start with Issaquah Creek. Most of you know where Issaquah Creek is. It drains into the south end of Lake Washington. There are a number of tributaries that drain into it, and just because I don't think you can talk about waters and watersheds without getting your feet wet, it's worth actually taking a look at what these streams look like. So some of the tributaries, the East Fork up in its headwaters, a little more debris thrown up on the floodplain as we get down closer into town, 15 Mile Creek coming off of Tiger Mountain, Holder Creek, and down in the main stem during a typical climatic episode. And then a nice aerial perspective of the Delta of Issaquah Creek and gazing back up into the watershed as a whole. First of all, from a watershed context, of course, I'm a geologist, and so I consider the geologic controls to be dominant in their influence. And of course, in Issaquah Creek, and in fact, all of the Puget Lowland, the occupation of the region by an ice sheet 16, 18,000 years ago, put a really profound template on both the topography of the region, on the deposits, and therefore on all of the surface water features that flow across that region. In addition, or as one of the consequences of that geologic history, we have a variety of sediment delivery processes that are certainly not unique to this region, but they are arrayed spatially and have certain relative distributions and importance that are characteristic of and really a consequence of those geologic history and processes. So in Issaquah Creek, we have landslides, we have road surface erosion, we have channel bank erosion, and these are all products of, and they vary in both space and time as a consequence of what we've done to the watershed and what we find out there in the watershed itself. This work that was done by Erin Nelson as part of her master's thesis some years ago, but we actually have a pretty good quantification of it, at least in Issaquah Creek. And we can compare this to other watersheds just to get a feeling for where we sit in considering this watershed, where this study, that would be Issaquah. Okay, so hold that thought, and now let's drift north a few thousand miles up to Grayling Creek. Grayling is a tributary of the Tonsina River, which drains into the Copper River. I chose this in part because I've been there, so I can tell you a little bit about it, and in part because actually from a size perspective, Grayling and Issaquah Creek are actually not too far apart. Issaquah is maybe 55, 59 square miles. Grayling is about 70 square miles, so we're very much in the ballpark, and you'll find that when we get down to Santa Paula Creek that we're in that same neighborhood as well. So here's an aerial view, and although I don't have a detailed geologic reconstruction, I trust most of you who have taken a Geology 101 class can recognize the Trunk Valley Glacier that once filled this area. It's a classic pattern. Headwater glaciers feed in and scour out these lovely U-shaped valleys. Here's a view looking up towards the drainage divide. As we wander a little bit farther down the valley, you still see this nice U-shaped valley with the channel finding its way down the middle of it. This is what some of the riverine reaches look in that area. It's really lovely out there. A few of our cohorts hanging out on the gravel bar as part of that river. A little farther down, you'll notice that there's actually some other deposits that are starting to encroach in on the valley. And they are a product of the geologic history, but they're also very relevant to the modern behavior of that river. And this is not the time for a systematic discussion of that, but clearly the presence of these gravelly terrace deposits produce abundant opportunities for sediment delivery into the river, which in turn influences both the channel morphology, the sediment caliber, and many of the attributes that we observe in looking at the river, and many of the attributes of how the river might respond to future changes. We're now going to slide all the way down the coast to Santa Paula Creek. This is a watershed of about 42 square miles, so again, we're very much in the same realm, but of course, we're in a very different, it's different down there, right? Southern California, it's different. So here we are. Again, from a geologic perspective, we're in an area of really quite remarkable geologic activity and upheaval. It's where the San Andreas Fault, which comes cruising along here, takes a little bend and then heads on out in this direction. You might say, well, what does the San Andreas Fault have to do with rivers? And the answer is that watersheds in this area are sitting on ground that is being uplifted at rates that are among the highest in the world. And that has substantial implications for the kind of materials that are there and the kind of sediment delivery that occurs. Here's a Google Earth view of it. It's slightly vertically exaggerated, but only slightly. These mountains go up very rapidly. Here's the creek kind of sneaking out from the canyon, heading on down. We'll get a few more views in a moment. This is what some of the upper tributaries look like. Moving a little farther downstream, you'll notice the bedrock up in here. You'll notice some really quite substantial boulders choking the stream. It's a little hard to get a scale, but I assure you that none of us are as tall as that. Looking a little farther downstream, and yet a little farther again. Again, we're now all as tall as this, but we'd have a hard time jumping over it. And then further down on the floodplain. This is clearly a very different river from the ones that I've shown you previously. And to try and force the morphology of this river into a template that's been established based on what you learned in Issaquah Creek or even Grayling Creek would probably not be terribly illuminating. Here's the geologic setting. Again, I promised you I'm a geologist, so we always have to start here. Santa Paula Creek, if you will, the watershed occupies much of this upper block. It flows across this fault, and this fault is uplifting at the rate of 1 to 2 millimeters per year. You may think, well, that's not very much, but over 1,000 years, that's a meter. Over 10,000 years, that's 10 meters. Things go up really fast, really quickly, and if we look at the geologic map, here's the fault, here's the creek flowing south, and again, we're coming up here at rates 1 to 2 millimeters a year that are, again, among the highest that we find outside of the Himalayas on the surface of the Earth. So the consequences of that are that we see strata that are noticeably bent, and these are not ancient, hard, compacted, metamorphic rocks. These are shallow marine sediments that can barely hold themselves together, except now they're 2,000 feet up in the air. And so they tend to fall apart. And so we get areas of the watershed like this that show up as practically melting, even on a Google Earth perspective. And certainly when we look at them in the field, that's exactly what we see. Landslides basically coming unglued even in this semi-arid environment. We also see areas of just massive sediment delivery off the hillsides into the upper headwaters. And that 6-inch notebook for scale is literally this high. This is the kind of sediment that's being delivered off of those areas. We have no processes in our part of the world that even remotely approach the magnitude of this. And so it should perhaps come as no surprise that we have no stream channels that even remotely behave the way these behave. It's also drier out there. Ventura is the closest rain gauge. It's about 15 miles away. And so you might say, well, golly, it doesn't really rain out there in Southern California, so who cares if you just dump a bunch of boulders in the stream? They probably just sit there, don't they? Of course, this is not where the story is told. So we can look at the isohedral maps for both regions, and I'm just going to focus now on Issaquah and Santa Paula. So here's the map from Western Washington, our 2-year, 24-hour rainstorm, depending on where exactly you are, somewhere between 3 to 5 inches of rain. And if we wander down, or excuse me, if we look at the 100-year, 24-hour rainfall, between 5 and 9 inches of rain. This 5-inch value is kind of what we expect to see out in the lowland, and then as we climb up into the hills, we certainly see more. Big rainstorm, right? Okay, at Santa Paula, you'll notice that the 2-year, 24-hour rainfall, even though it doesn't rain very much there, when it does, it kind of gets it going at about the same rate as Issaquah on these storms that have a 50-50 chance of being equaled or exceeded every year. However, at the 100-year, we have basically double the potential intensity. And in fact, it has been noted that in this part of the world, we are in portions of the San Gabriel and San Bernardino Mountains, has a maximum intensity greater than pretty much any place else in the in the continental United States. So we have this interesting combination of weak rocks uplifted very rapidly, producing very steep, very sediment-rich flows in areas that are dry until they're wet. And when they are wet, they're very wet. So let's look at the hydrologic side of things. Here's the USGS gauge over the last 40-odd years. Maximum flood somewhere up in here. You can kind of get a sense of this overall distribution. And again, this is about 59 square miles. Here's Santa Paula Creek. You notice that most years, really not much happens. But again, when it happens, it really happens. And when you compare this to Issaquah Creek, you know, Issaquah Creek is barely makes the charts. And I'll remind you that this watershed is actually only about 2/3 the size that of Issaquah. And then there is no gauge, I'm sorry to say, on Grayling Creek, but if we go one tributary downstream, we find Squirrel Creek, and I chose it because it's close and its area is very close to that of Grayling. And I don't know if you remember those other numbers, but we're an order of magnitude lower. So climatologically, there are huge differences, and those are expressed hydrologically as huge differences. And hopefully it therefore comes as no sort of terrible realization that maybe the streams are different too, and maybe they behave differently, and maybe we need to be aware of that as we think about them. So here's a view of Santa Paula Creek at a low flow, and there's a view of the same spot at a high flow. So when these things go, these things go. This is the flood of record in 2005, but it is worth appreciating what a serious flood can look like. Some of the deposits that came down as a consequence of that flood. So, in my remaining 4 or so minutes, let's talk about why we need this watershed understanding. So I want to give you a little example, first of all. Here's a housing development that I would argue was clearly not developed with a watershed understanding. As you look out here, you might notice a little dip in the skyline and say, I wonder what that is. And you say, it kind of looks like there's a house built on the corresponding geomorphic feature associated with fluvial activity. This is the view from the backyard of that house. Now looking down, you'll notice the 6-inch culvert here designed to catch the flow. 3 months, I kid you not, 3 months later, that's what it looked like. The 6-inch culvert is somewhere right there. So useful to recognize where you're on an alluvial fan and what the potential is for that fan to actually express its nature. So I'd like to, just in the last couple of minutes, and actually it's worth mentioning in terms of sediment study, here's the Issaquah sediment load, and here's the Santa Paula Creek sediment load, for which we also did an analysis. Just noting that it's about 40 times the average annual load of Issaquah Creek, albeit in a very much more episodic nature because of the climatology out there. So if we look at actually each of these watersheds, they all have alluvial fans, and I'd like to just spend the last minute or two looking at them each. Here's the fan. We actually call it a delta for Issaquah Creek. Here's the delta, and it is actually a delta, but with an alluvial fan for Grayling Creek. And here's the alluvial fan for Santa Paula Creek, and you'll notice that it looks a little different from Grayling's, but it is still an alluvial fan. In 1938, it looked like this. Here's the river coming out, or the creek coming out, joining with the Santa Clara River. Here's the growing town of Santa Paula. In 2005, here is the grown town of Santa Paula. You'll notice that the Army Corps has done its number on the lower reach in an effort to keep everything tidy and well-behaved, as only a river that can run 23,000 CFS can be. And as you go out onto that fan, you'll see that, it's like if you're given lemons, make lemonade. So everybody landscapes with the boulders that have come trundling down the alluvial fan at times in the past. The city fathers and mothers do not apparently want to landscape Main Street with that, and so they've removed all of the boulders. But we're in the same setting. It's the same watershed that it always has been. It just is one that functions much more episodically. And so if you imagine that you understood rivers on the basis of what you've learned from the Pacific Northwest or from the Midwest, you might come to some very different and potentially very mistaken impressions about how the system works. And so we think about these alluvial settings, and we apply our understanding from one place and believe that since kind of gravity and water and dirt all kind of look about the same, whether we're in Alaska or the Pacific Northwest or Southern California, I think we are too often inclined to imagine that the product of those, namely the streams in our watersheds, are going to behave the same way. And of course, that is not always the case. And on that note, I will thank you very much. Tom.
Derek, one of the complaints I hear relatively frequently is that standards for preserving watersheds shouldn't be one size fits all. And but all of our standards, in a sense, are one size fits all. Like how many fire hydrants you put in over a certain stretch of ground. How would you respond to that one size fits all?
So the question is, our standards are typically one size fit all when it comes to protecting watersheds. What's my response? My response would be that, first, certainly the political and legal process is not a terribly nuanced one, and so in general, simpler really is better. On the other hand, because the world is so different in different places, what we understand or have learned from one part of the world is not necessarily going to apply to another. And that sometimes we can draw gross distinctions, like if you're operating on someone, it's good to keep them with oxygen, no matter what's wrong with them. But in other elements, when we're trying to preserve systems for their ecological benefits, for their human benefits, that we do actually have to think a little bit, and that one size is never going to do enough to achieve the goals that we've set for ourselves. So certain sizes certain standards are worth maintaining for every system, however widely spread. But as we raise the bar on what we're trying to achieve, we actually have to think a little harder.
The California stream, does it respond to the changes in impervious area the same way that a Northwest stream?
That is a fascinating question. So there are those who argue, in fact, there are those who, God help me, take my research and the research of others who have worked in this area, and they say, Booth says, Schuller says, 10% good, 11% bad. And they apply it in Southern California even more sort of enthusiastically than we ever applied it up here. I think you can make some very basic arguments why it should not necessarily be that way, and yet people who have studied these Southern California streams much more than me have clearly convinced themselves that they really do work the same way. So this is a largely uninformed answer that I can't believe that they respond the same, but I haven't looked at them enough to refute those that insist that it must be so. But I don't believe it.
Good. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
I can't resist jumping in on that last question. That the headwaters of the Santa Paula Creek's in the Sespe National Wildlife Refuge, where the condors are. So it's basically an undeveloped watershed except for the mouth, where Santa Paula is. The other thing is that wildfires are generally allowed to burn without being intensively fought, as they are further south in the San Gabriel Mountains. So What you see there is a watershed that's naturally very flashy anyway. That's not an unusual condition for Southern California. And to superimpose that on top of that, a lot of basically impervious soils through development just exacerbates the problem. So, but a very interesting talk.